and went out. Shitload curled his twin optical skull erections down and looked at the sad bottle draining its contents into the dirt. After a moment, he turned back to us and said, "Put that shit down and come with me, fools." He backed away from us, seeming to realize his eyes were dangling from his skull, and in a series of sickening, jerky neck movements sucked them back in. We stood there for a moment, looked at each other with a kind of deflated shame and defeat, then did what he said. They were waiting for me, I realized, too late. They were waiting for me to push the attack, to lead them. Welcome aboard the David Wong disappointment train, fuckers. We weren't in Vegas. A quick glance around showed me we were squarely in the middle of rural nowhere. It was a windy night, and in small-town Nevada, that apparently means dust. Justin, the hybrid walking demon hive and Limp Bizkit fan, led us across a dusty yard onto a paint-peeled dusty porch where a pair of ancient and very dusty shoes sat mummifying in the dusty desert air. The door was ajar, and had only a perfectly round hole where the knob should have been. Propped next to the door was a dust-covered but new FedEx box, which almost certainly was a delivery mistake since this place looked to be in its 10th year of vacancy. Justin pushed in through the door, indifferently kicking the box inside as he passed. As we moved inside, I noticed for the first time that Justin had an old, mud-smeared glass jar in his hand, and I vaguely remembered seeing it, or one just like it, in the Jamaican's makeshift basement. He placed it on the floor and walked around to us one by one, arranging our bodies, seated, in a semicircle around it. I saw a speech coming and could only pray that he wouldn't come out sounding like a white kid raised next to a cornfield trying to record interlude skits for a gangster rap album. Shitload said, "This world is shit, yo. Oh, God damn it. How do you people be getting around in this? All in these bodies and shit. You act all scared that I'm gonna kill you when it's the best thing I could do for you, yo. Dead world, man. It's alternate layers of rot and shit and rot and shit." I looked around the dim group, saw moonlight from the window cracks reflecting off tears on Jennifer's cheeks. Big Jim had his eyes closed, maybe in prayer. Fred Chu looked around as if uninterested, stroking his goatee with one hand and fidgeting with a strip of carpet foam with the other. John was staring vacantly at a spot on the other side of the room, already distracted into a dull stupor. Molly licked her crotch. "Ladies and gentlemen, the undisclosed Hell Conqueror Strike Force." To at least feel like I was doing something, I said, "Dead world, is that where you're from?" "No, dude. That's where you're from. It's where we are now. This place, it's a horror show. If the guy next to you decides to knock you out of this world forever, he can do it with just a piece of metal or, hell, even his bare hand. You blobs, you sit there, chilling in this room, and I can smell the rot of dead animals soaking in the acid of your guts. You suck the life from the innocent creatures of this world so you can clock another day. You're machines that run on the terror and pain and mutilation of other lives. You'll scrape the world clean of every green and living thing until starvation goes 187 on every one of your sorry asses. Your desperation to put off death leading to the ultimate death of everybody and everything. Dude, I can't believe you ain't all paralyzed by the pure, naked horror of this place." After a long, long pause, John said, "Thank you." John's eyes never moved as he spoke, and suddenly I saw a look there, a confidence. I followed his gaze, saw what he was seeing, and then quickly looked away again. I glanced back at the Justin monster, wondering if he had caught on. But he was busy. He twisted the lid off the old pickle jar, and a small, shriveled thing, like a dried-up earthworm, dropped out and landed quietly on the floor. Shitload went to the kitchen, and I heard him messing around with the sink in there. No water. He came back, studied our faces, and pointed to Fred. "Piss on it," he commanded. I was so baffled by this that I wasn't even sure I had heard him right. But Fred, having perfected going with the flow to a degree that philosophers could study for centuries, shrugged and said, "Okay." He stood, unzipped, urinated on the floor, zipped up, and sat back down. The little black-dried worm sliver sat in the middle of the bubbling puddle. Nothing for a long time. Maybe a minute. And then the worm twitched. Jennifer screamed. Everybody jumped. The shriveled nothing grew. And grew. And grew. Just add water. A hand formed. A human hand, pink and the size of a baby's. Stretching out from behind it instead of an arm was something like an insect leg. It was a foot long, springing out to length before our eyes like a radio antenna. Something like a shell took shape. I saw an eye, red, and clustered like a fly's. Another eye, this one with a round pupil, like a mammal, grew in next to it. Then another eye, yellow, with a black slit down the center. Reptilian. The thing grew, and grew some more. It grew to the size of a rabbit, then a small dog, then stopped when it was about a foot and a half high, and maybe 3 feet wide, probably the same overall mass as Molly. The finished creature seemed to be assembled from spare parts. It had a tail like a scorpion curling up off its back. It walked on seven, yes, seven legs, each ending in one of those small pink infantile hands. It had a head that was sort of an inverted heart shape, a bank of mismatched eyes in an arc over a hooked black beak like a parrot's. On its head, no kidding, it had a tuft of neatly groomed blonde hair that I swear on my mother's grave was a wig held on with a rubber band chin strap. What was strange about it, or rather, what was stranger about it, was that the two sections of its body, the hindquarters and the abdomen, were not connected. There was a good 2 inches of space between them, and when it turned sideways, you could see right through the thing. But it moved in unison, as if they were connected by invisible tissue. The little monster stood twitching there on the floor like a newborn calf, still dripping with urine. John said, "Huh." Fred said, "Guys, can you all see that fucking thing, or is it just me?" The beast moved in circles, looking around the room. Justin said to us, "Don't move. If I ask it to, it'll kill you, yo. You don't know what that thing's capable of." "Shit, looking at the thing, I don't even think it knows. But that ain't my goal. I could have capped you all back home if that was the plan." "It ain't." The thing turned and turned, staring down each of us, its dozen eyes blinking at different intervals. It finally stopped, looking my direction. Molly stirred behind me, a low growl rising from her. "All I need you to do is hold still, yo. In a minute, ain't none of you gonna remember why you got all worked up and shit." The creature crouched, then vanished in a blur. I threw myself back, expected the monster to suddenly be on me, but it wasn't. I heard a horrible, high-pitched yelp behind me and turned to find the monster on Molly's back, its legs wrapped around her body, dug into her fur like steel cables. Jennifer screamed, everyone stirred. Justin shouted at us to stay down, stay down. I watched as the thing whipped back that scorpion tail. Did I say it was like a scorpion? The freaking tail had hair on it. And with a flick, the end was buried in the dog's hide. The length of the tail started pulsing and twitching. It was pumping something into her. Molly whimpered. And then it was over. The beast jumped off. Molly looked terrorized but kept her feet. I saw the tip of the monster's scorpion tail and noticed a drip of thick, black fluid trickling out. Soy sauce. "Wait, what? That's where it comes from?" A burst of movement behind me, shuffling feet and shouts. John was making his move, diving in the direction we had been looking earlier. He skidded on the floor and seized the white FedEx box. Shitload was on him fast, Bruce Lee fast. He delivered a kick to John's gut that actually knocked him back a couple feet. Then he wrenched the box from John's arms. Shitload looked baffled, moved to throw the box aside, but stopped, cold. He looked at the label, then at John, then at me, then at the label again. I stood and moved slowly toward them. Shitload stared at John and said, "What's in here?" John said nothing, looked like he wasn't too sure himself. I moved closer still, not understanding. Shitload stiffened his arm toward John in a Heil Hitler motion. This confused us for a second, before a slit appeared in his palm and something like a mouth puckered there. A thin stream of thick yellow liquid dripped onto the floor, gathering in a small smoking puddle that quickly ate through the floorboards with a soft hiss.
"Tell me,"
Justin demanded. I looked down at the label on the box. The package was addressed to John's real name, to this house, in this Nevada town. It was dated yesterday, sent via overnight delivery with John's own small, neat handwriting. "Tell me or I'll melt your face, yo. What is it, like a bomb? John shrugged, said, Why don't you open it, and we'll both find out. Shitload sat the box on the floor, said, Take it outside. Okay. John bent over to pick it up. Stop. Leave it where it is. Okay. He pointed to the wig monster and said, Open the box. The thing apparently understood because it trundled over and started tearing at the flap with its beak. After several long, clumsy minutes of this, during which I tried to show it the little tear strip all FedEx boxes have, it finally stuck its snout inside and pulled out a sheet of wrinkled notebook paper. Shitload picked it up, saw scrawled on it in big ink pen letters, John, look by the bush in the front yard. The Justin monster turned to John and said, What's out there? A weapon? You trying to gank me? John didn't answer. Shitload pointed to the wig beast and said, If any of you try to move, that thing will rip off all your limbs, leave you alive, and plant 500 eggs in your belly. You down with that? We were. Shitload tossed aside the note and strode out the front door. We could indeed see a bush out there, shivering in the breeze. Had John, under the influence of the sauce, somehow planted something out there ahead of time? How? And what? A gun? A pipe bomb? A trained badger? Nothing would have surprised me. The creature, formerly known as Justin White, walked out to the bush and looked down, kicking around at the base of it. I glanced over at John, who waited with the same anticipation, apparently having completely forgotten the plan once the sauce wore off. The wig monster prowled around between us, and I wondered if we should all try sprinting out the back door. Outside, Justin had found nothing. He turned to walk back and was blown off his feet. A thunderous boom echoed in the desert air, followed by a faint mechanical ka-chunk of a pump shotgun. A second shot sounded, then a third. The wig beast in front of us hissed, baring its teeth. Yes, it had both teeth and a beak, seeming to know that something was amiss and that we should all be ripped to shreds immediately. We were frozen by the thing, all of us desperate to jump up and watch our salvation. But any slight shift of a limb would cause the wig thing to spin in that direction. A figure moved toward the open door out in the darkness. The creature spun toward it, and when I saw who came through, I found myself rooting for the wig monster. Say what you want about Shitload and his disjointed pet, but neither of them either tried to shoot me or set me on fire. The same cannot be said for Detective Lawrence Morgan Freeman Appleton, who strode into the house loading shells into a pistol-grip riot gun. His eyes caught the jumbled creature on the floor. He raised the gun. The thing turned toward him and meowed like a cat. It crouched, leaned his direction, and vanished right as John screamed, Move! Morgan spun and ducked off to his right. The wig monster appeared in midair in the spot where Morgan was standing a half second earlier, flailing its limbs in his direction. The thing tumbled to the carpet. Morgan lowered the shotgun. A blast thundered in the room. Bits of monster flew. Morgan racked the shotgun, ejecting a blue plastic shell. There any more of them? Jim said. No, but that guy out there ain't dead. We all got to our feet, everyone relieved at their rescue. Everyone but me. I still had a puncture in the middle of my chest, like a third nipple, where the good detective here had shot me before trying to roast me alive. I wondered if they noticed Morgan didn't exactly read Justin his rights before blowing a hole in him. I mean, I did the same thing, but that's why society doesn't let me carry a badge. Morgan started to speak, maybe to say, I blew a hole in his chest the size of a football, jackass. I'm pretty sure he's freaking dead. But then his eyes locked on mine, realizing the other guy he'd shot in the heart this weekend was now standing and breathing in front of him. There was a moment when my eyes met Morgan's, when once more I got a flash of his thoughts. Nothing coherent, just fear and exhaustion and cold, deadly purpose. In that 2 seconds we shared, I knew the detective's mind was working full-time to crush any remaining doubts about what he had to do. He had a mission, and had traveled across the country to carry it out. He was saving the world, and in his mind that meant that anyone dumb enough, unlucky enough, or crazy enough to take the sauce, to risk becoming a conduit for whatever otherworldly invasion was waiting to use them as a doormat, needed to die. Morgan had a decision to make. He glanced over his shoulder, squinting into the darkness for Justin. But he didn't turn, and he still had the shotgun pointing in our direction. 6 of us, maybe we were hostages, and maybe we were hives. Maybe he had thought he'd burst in and we'd all be in alien-style cocoons and he could just torch the place and declare it mission accomplished. But here we were, exhausted and filthy and wounded. To this day, I don't know if he was struggling with the moral implications of gunning down half a dozen civilians, or if he was mentally counting to see if he had that many shells left in the gun. John leaned over and picked up the FedEx box. He peered inside, turned it over. A pack of cigarettes and a lighter slid out into his hand. He plucked one cigarette out and lit it. He reached into the waistband of his hospital pants and pulled out a little bottle of some kind of brown liquor he had lifted from the truck. Took a drink. I was surprised he hadn't mailed himself a burrito, too. I said to Morgan, "It's a long fucking story, but we're on your side. John totally lured Justin out there for you just now. Just don't fucking ask me how." Morgan turned, pushing back through the door, leading with a shotgun. I followed, careful not to step in the wig monster chunks scattered on the floor underfoot. The cop was a lot more surprised than I was to see Shitload was no longer on the desert floor. He poised the gun in front of him, turning like a turret, then spun on the beer truck as it rumbled to life and rolled onto the road. Morgan ran, ripped off three shots as the red taillight shrank into the distance. He stomped back toward us, said, "Shit!" "I know where he's going," I said, "and I'll tell you if you promise to take us with you, and not to shoot me again." He sucked in a breath, scanning the faces of our group. Finally, he said,
"Okay.
Luxor Hotel. Don't ask me how I know." 30 seconds later, we were all crammed into Morgan's rental SUV like it was a clown car, peeling down the blacktop. From the passenger seat, I watched the headlights swallowing up the road and said, "There's something like a massive seance planned. It's a guy named Marconi. Apparently Shitload, Justin, has business there." All 10 of Morgan's fingers were clamped around the steering wheel as the speedometer crept upward.
"I know."
"You do? How?" Everyone in the truck lurched first right, then left as Morgan swerved to pass a car.
"Brock Wholesale reported the liquor truck missing yesterday. I happened to catch word of a gas station attendant in Missouri who said a beer truck driver told him he needed directions to Las Vegas, then punched him in the balls, and told him his daughters would be live meat cocoons for the leech pool. Man thought that was strange, phoned it in. I just followed the same directions he gave Justin, drove balls to the wall. Then I came up on this exit and just had a feeling, you know, like an intuition."
The mention of intuition gave me a cold feeling in my gut. I glanced back at John. It got his attention, too.
"I followed my gut and there was the truck, parked by that old house."
Morgan scratched the side of his cheek, 2-day stubble sounding like sandpaper. The engine growled. The scenery sprayed past my window. I asked, "If this thing makes it to the Luxor, what happens?"
"Let's just say I came a long way to make sure that don't happen."
From behind us, John said, "If you've been following us since we got kidnapped, then you must have been up for more than 2 days.
"More like 50 hours.
We rode silently for a minute. Less than a minute, actually, according to Morgan.
"Make that 50 hours and 37.23 seconds. It's the adrenaline, I guess. I ain't really been tired. The thrill of the hunt."
We drove in silence for a moment. Red taillights appeared up ahead. I reached out and gripped the dashboard.
Morgan said, "That, and those loud, piercing voices in my head."
Morgan's eyes exploded. He shrieked as 2 sprays of blood flecked over the windshield. Jennifer screamed behind me. John and Fred bellowed, "Oh, fuck!" simultaneously. Little white rods poured down the cop's face, swirled around inside the truck. He let go of the steering wheel. I reached over and grabbed it. We left the road. We shook, rattled, bumped. The horizon and sky swapped places in the windshield, and the roof of the car bashed me in the shoulder. Glass bits rained down in my eyes and ears and up my nose. The dashboard punched me in the forehead. The roof hammered me a second time, and Molly's furry ass rolled over my face. Finally, the vehicle banged to a stop. Silence. Only a soft chittering over the desert breeze. And then came the voices. Chapter 6. Meet Dr. Marconi. That sucked. I pried my eyes open, feeling scratchy little bits in there that could either be sand or glass. I worked the lids open and found myself staring at dirt. Everything was upside down. I was hanging by my seatbelt. I felt like every single joint in my body had been wrenched painfully out of socket. It was agony from head to toe, so dark now that it took me a moment to realize that the massive, spreading pool on the ceiling was not motor oil, but blood. I craned my neck over and saw hunks of meat flying off what had been Officer Freeman Appleton, in juicy, ragged, pink and yellow layers, bone and ribs and a spongy mass that must have been lungs. Out from the meaty shreds came rushing masses of the tiny white demon rod things, swirling around the interior of the truck like rice in a blender. That's not what caused me to panic. Not that, or the faint, wet, ripping sounds next to me. No. What got me moving, what sent me clutching at the seatbelt clasp, was the sound of the swarm. Oh, that sound. Not something coming through my ears at all, but a kind of shrill electricity in my brain, a million sharp, spiky, poison thoughts ricocheting around my head. Imagine 50,000 men trapped on a desert island, deprived of food and water and sex, but somehow kept alive for 50,000 years. Then, after they've been tormented 100 steps beyond insanity, tortured past self-mutilation and cannibalism, somebody drops off a sculpture of a naked woman made from T-bone steaks. If you could then capture the sound of them simultaneously fucking and eating and tearing her to shreds and broadcast it into the center of your skull at 10,000 watts, it would still sound absolutely nothing like what I heard. It was madness, and desperation, and deprivation, and torment gone supernova, screeches and howls and sprinkled in here and there, my own name. It blew every thought out of my head, tore my mind open. I was frantic, patting around for the clasp to the seatbelt with hands shaking like a Parkinson's patient. I could vaguely hear actual screams around me, right from the back seat, but they might as well have been 1,000 miles away. These little white streaks were buzzing around my face now, past my ears, skipping over my skin. I got my fingers around the little plastic box that held the seatbelt, but couldn't find a button, couldn't see it, pressed and pulled and finally just started clawing at the thing like a little kid in a tantrum. I felt this itching over my bare arms, and then little pricks like needles, and I knew what it was, I fucking knew. And I started contorting my body to crawl free from the seatbelt like an animal wrenching from a trap. Movement all around me in the darkness. Glass shattering in the back seat. Somebody getting dragged out. Screaming. I ran my hand over my forearm and 1,000 of the rods scattered off into the air. I heard a resulting uproar in the voices. Shrieks, like teenage banshees at a boy band concert, except nothing like that at all. The sound. It was so massive and yet so compressed in my skull that it was a physical pressure against my temples. I thought I could feel wheezing, creaking fissures in the bone. Then, hands were grabbing me, pulling at the seatbelt. A hand came into view and with a flick, there was suddenly a narrow blade there, a switchblade cutting at the strap. I fell free, crashed down. Four hands were dragging me out of the wreckage by the shirt and shoulders, my back scraping over a bed of glass bits. It was Fred Chu and John pulling me free. Everybody was yelling, freaking out. Molly was dancing around and barking, total panic at the sight of the little cloud of white insects blowing around me like pillow feathers. The worms had settled on my arm again and were landing on my neck and face. I brushed them off, swatted at them in the air. John seized my arm by the wrist, dug out the brown bottle of alcohol from his pants, and doused the arm with it. This seemed to annoy the flying worm things more than anything, and my skin was on fire with their attempts to dig their way in. I sputtered, "That ain't helping. The alcohol isn't hurting the—" John flicked his lighter and set my arm on fire. I said before that my skin was on fire with the pain, but being confronted so soon after that sentiment with the actual experience, I admit that other thing was nothing like my skin actually being on fire. But even the white heat on my arm was nothing next to the pain that suddenly erupted inside my skull. Hundreds of the worms were burned alive, and the psychic outcry was like shoving my head inside a 747 engine. It was a nuclear bomb of sound, earth-shattering, feeling like an explosion of razor blades in my cranium. And then, silence. John was rolling my arm in the dust, patting out the flames. The skin was beet red and peeling in places. I sat up, tried to focus my eyes, tried to get to my feet, fell back down on my ass. I saw John had blood running down his forehead, and he was trying to wipe it from his eyes, the empty liquor bottle at his feet. He leaned over and puked. Jennifer was on her knees in the dirt, had a chunk missing from her upper thigh, and her hair was matted to the side of her head with blood. Big Jim was pointing and screaming. Molly was barking. Fred, screaming, thrashing around as if on fire. The swarm had found him. The flying worms poured out of the wrecked SUV like a kicked hornet's nest. All landed on Fred. He was coughing, choking, the rods gushing into his wide-open mouth. In 5 seconds, it was over. Fred collapsed. We all knew he wasn't dead. Jim and John and Molly stared toward Fred in dull shock, a silence settling over the scene so heavy it was almost a solid thing. Only Jennifer moved. She sprinted toward the dead SUV, a little squirt of blood jumping from her leg wound with each step. She crawled in, grabbed something, then backed out quickly. Fred moved. He twitched, flopped onto his back, then clumsily got to his feet. Everybody flinched and took steps backward. I forced myself to my feet over the protest of my leg muscles. Fred, if it was still Fred, looked confused for a moment, then brushed himself off and said, "It's okay, guys. I'm okay. I'm okay." Jennifer ran up, and I saw what she had retrieved from the SUV. It was Morgan's shotgun. The thing was gleaming in the moonlight with a layer of tacky blood. Without asking, Jim took it from her and checked the chamber to see if a shell was loaded. He laid it over his shoulder, like he was suddenly the captain of this crew. He said, "We gotta get a car, guys, somehow." Nobody moved. Jennifer looked at me expectantly. What was I supposed to do? I could barely keep my feet. I looked Fred dead in the eyes, searching them. I said to Fred, "Go flag down a car." Jim nodded like this was a perfectly good plan and followed Fred as he walked toward the highway. Jennifer gave me an exasperated look, went up to Jim, and tore the gun from his hands. He spun, asked her what the heck she was doing. She backed away from him, and I half expected her to blow a hole through the infested Fred with a shotgun. She didn't. Instead, she went right to me and pushed the gun into my hands. Very slowly and carefully, Big Jim said to me, "What are you going to do with that, David?" John, Jen, and I stood side by side, facing Fred and Jim from about 10 feet away. Fred said, "Whoa, guys, guys, we're all shook up here, okay?" Jennifer said, "Jim, were you not paying attention to what just happened? That's not Fred. Not anymore." "We don't know what happened," snapped Jim, glancing over at Fred. "Does anybody here understand this, really? Screw you, if you think you do." Fred said, "Guys, look, I don't know what you think you saw, but I'm still Fred in here. Ask me anything. I'm me. I mean, we were all in that car when the cop exploded. Any of us could be infected or whatever, but we gotta hang together. We're like the fucking good guys here, right?" Everyone looked at me. I was the armed one. I looked down, as if deferring to the shotgun. It was cold, heavy, and sticky with Morgan's blood. A breeze blew past us. From my right, Molly let out a low growl. I closed my eyes, let out a long breath, and said, "Go flag down a car." Big Jim and Fred turned once more and took a step toward the highway. I let out a breath and took 2 steps forward. I raised the shotgun and blew Fred's head off his shoulders. Blood flew. I saw it mist in the moonlight, for a split second frozen in the air like a snapshot. There was that feeling again, the sparks in my head, the old violence high, the electricity of it shivering through me. Fred's body slumped to its knees, then fell flat on its chest. Blood. Screaming. Panic. The old familiar sights and sounds. I had been here before. Big Jim recoiled, splattered with Fred's blood, yelling something I couldn't hear. Everything was dull, slow. I craned my head to see John, and he had an expression I had seen there a few times before, something like fear and pity. I wanted to put the butt of the shotgun through his face. I loathed that look. It said, "You are what you are, Dave, and that's that." I caught a glimpse of Jen, her hands clasped over her mouth. This seemed like such a fucking good idea 10 seconds ago, didn't it? There was movement out of the corner of my eye, and it was Big Jim, stomping toward me, rage lighting up his face. That was a familiar look for him, too, seen in 12 high school fights, his fists about to come loose like fighting dogs tearing out of their cages. "Yeah, Jim, you can quote the Bible to me, but you and I got the same sickness." I aimed the shotgun right at his face. Jim looked into the barrel, took two more steps, then raised his eyes to meet mine. He stopped. His eyes never moving from mine, he said, "The day after the Hitchcock thing, back in school, I saw you, you and your buddies, laughing. Laughing in the hallway. Not 12 hours after Billy died. I know all about you, Dave. You got the devil in." I pumped the shotgun. "This is not a conversation, Jim." Every muscle was tensed. We faced off that way seemingly forever, the trigger pressing into the skin of my finger. "Shoot him. Shoot everybody." John broke the moment. He sprinted up toward Fred's prone body, grabbing and dragging it. "Get him to the truck!" Jennifer went to help him, but the two of them were making slow, halting progress, pulling the dead weight through the sand. John said, "Dave, these things are starting to come out of him." Jim stared me down a moment longer and then turned and walked toward them. John muttered something to him, but Big Jim knocked both him and Jen aside. He dragged Fred's body back to the wreckage of the SUV and laid him against the rear door. A familiar fuzzy cloud was emerging from the ragged stump that had been Fred Chu's head. Jim stomped toward me and, with a quick, impossibly strong motion, easily ripped the shotgun from my hands. He turned and aimed at the gas tank of the SUV. I flinched from the expected explosion, had the crazy sudden urge for a ball of fire to spew out and reduce all of us to ash. Nothing. Instead, there was a patch of little holes in the metal, a heavy rain of gasoline splattering down the rear and onto the prone body of Fred Chu. John stepped up to his corpse, flicked open his lighter, and tossed it down. Fred Chu went up in a ball of flames. The fire licked up the trunk of the SUV, reached the gas tank, and ignited the contents with a heavy, metallic thunk, sending us flopping to the ground, little bits of metal plunking softly into the sand around us. Jim got to his feet and walked toward me again, the shotgun pointed at the ground. The adrenaline was draining from me so fast I thought I'd be sitting in a puddle of it soon. So tired. So tired. 2 feet away, Jim raised the gun. "Man, just do it. Just do it and let me sleep out here in the sand until the sun goes supernova and turns the whole world into a charred memory." He threw the shotgun in my gut and walked away. The barrel was warm. We all got to our feet and watched thousands of the little particles swarm out of Fred, burning like sparks over a stirred campfire. In my head, the concert of damned voices faded and died. John said, "Do you think that's all of them? The worms, whatever they are? Do you think we got all of them?" I didn't answer. "Because I got a feeling that if just a few of them get away, hell, if just one of them gets out and gets into a body, they'll multiply, lay eggs, and do what they do." Nobody answered. What was there to say? It took us 15 minutes to flag down a car. I convinced Jennifer to stand out by the road alone, shivering and mussed up and looking victimized, one shapely leg coated in crimson. Soon a shiny new SUV pulled over, driven by a young guy and his wife on their honeymoon or whatever. As soon as their passenger door was open, I sprinted out and put the gun in their face, forced them out while Jim apologized profusely, swearing we would bring it back. The five of us and the dog piled in, and we drove into the night. "I don't like it," said Jennifer softly, as if afraid the looming dark thing on the horizon could hear us. She was looking at the Luxor Las Vegas Hotel, a pyramid jutting into the night sky, big and black and geometric, like something from the year 3000. We were parked in the lot of a massive neon-lined steakhouse maybe a quarter mile away, all of us beaten and stinking of smoke and looking like war refugees. We had ducked into a truck stop restroom just outside of the city and washed as much blood off ourselves as we could. Jim spat out 2 teeth. John was pretty sure he had a concussion and would still be vomiting if he had anything in his stomach. I had double vision in one eye, and in general, I felt like I had been run through a wood chipper. We bought 4 first aid kits and fixed ourselves up as best we could. Jennifer patched her thigh with a roll of ace bandages and a tampon. We bought armloads of convenience store food and sat eating as we drove around looking for the Luxor. This parking lot was as far as we got before somebody asked what the plan was. "The Justin thing is in there. Right now," Jim said, nodding toward the Luxor. "So what are we waiting for? This whole thing, it could be going down right this minute for all we know, and we're out here doing nothing. John said, if he summons Satan, we'd see it from here, right? This was the most any of us had spoken since the accident and the ensuing clusterfuck. I said, first problem is we gotta get into this thing. Guy like Marconi probably attracts a lot of nutjobs. Gotta think the doors will be guarded, and I don't particularly feel like shooting my way in there. Jim said, think, David. The seance, or whatever it is happening inside a casino. You won't get 5 feet inside the door with a gun before 9 guys in suits tackle you. And shove your head in a vise, John added, helpfully. I said, well, I don't like our chances without the gun, unless Jim wants to try to quote Bible verses at it. Jennifer put up her hand, said, guys, let's not make this into a dick-measuring contest, okay? There was silence for a moment. Then John said, that's good, because it wouldn't be no contest at all. Silence again. That is, I'm referring to my cock being bigger than either of yours. I sighed and said, John, I don't think anyone in this vehicle is in the mood to... John, let me make one thing clear, Jim said, cutting me off in his most stern evangelical voice. Every man is blessed with his gifts from the Lord. One of mine happens to be a penis large enough that if it had a penis of its own, my penis's penis would be larger than your penis. There was a moment of stunned silence. Then I heard Jen start laughing so hard, I thought she would choke. Fuck all of you, John retorted. You don't even exist. We're all just a figment of my cock's imagination. Jim tried to suppress his laughter and failed. One more victim sucked in by John. You get in the room with him and you just fall into a warm pool of beer and video games and penis jokes, staring out at the universe with him and saying, do you believe this shit? I thought, not for the first time, that John could start a pretty fucking successful cult. I looked down at the shotgun in my lap, a heavy, cold, hateful thing still coated in grit and blood. I noticed something else, a broad lump in my pants pocket. I dug into it and pulled out the folded envelope of cash I had gotten from the alley guy yesterday. I wondered if I wound up not using it if I should go find the guy and give it back to him. From behind me, Molly barked. John was looking off across the parking lot now, where a massive customized RV sat like a beached whale. Behind it was an 18-wheeler, painted white with neon outlines, some kind of logo airbrushed on the side. He asked, I wonder what's in there. Big Jim said, shipment of fags, probably. The asshole's a comedian all of a sudden. This seemed to anger Molly, who stared out the windshield and went into a barking frenzy. I reached back and, for the first time in my life, smacked a dog across the nose with an envelope full of cash. Jennifer said, thank you. John said, there might be some clothes in that RV. We could change, look normal. Get Dave an overcoat to conceal the gun, then charge into the Luxor, find Justin, and open a can of kill-ass. We can't break into somebody's RV, I said. John squinted at the logo on the side of the truck. That RV doesn't belong to a person. It belongs to Elton John. You know the band? Jen said, seriously? Molly retreated to the rear and started biting at the luggage the newlyweds had stacked in it. They probably had packed some sausages in there or something. John said, yeah, look at the sign. I bet the truck is their concert stuff. Jim said, Elton John is a guy, not a band. Please don't get him started, I said. There was that one video where he was in different outfits and, for the last time, those were all different guys, Dave. I looked it up. They're brothers. Oh, Jesus, forget it. Who cares? I gripped the shotgun and considered shooting myself in the head. A slow smile spread over John's face. He turned to me and said the 5 most horrifying words he knows. Dave, I have a plan. If the aliens who helped the Egyptians build the pyramids returned to Earth and opened a casino, it would look like the Luxor, Las Vegas. The thing was a massive, gleaming black glass pyramid with a line of white lights that pulsed up its 4 corners. We had just pulled into the Luxor parking lot, and we were watching 2 cop cars and a tow truck messing with Justin's abandoned beer hauler, which had been carelessly run up onto the curb. The cops and the tow guy all looked a little confused by the scene. I said, let's go. We filed out of the SUV and strode toward the front entrance, giving the cops a wide berth. Jennifer looked up at it and whispered to me, "I don't like this place."
"You already said that."
"It looks like the end of the world, somehow. Like those huge, scary future buildings in Blade Runner. Black with the fire coming out of the tops and all that."
Big Jim said, "Yeah. Yeah. And those gigantic big screens with huge Asian women on them. I watched that movie when I was a kid and I started crying." Big Jim adjusted his cape. The entrance was ahead, opened wide like a maw, the guts inside showing gleaming solid gold.
"You know what else scared me?" Jen said, reaching up to scratch where a bundle of black feathers was tickling her neck. "Independence Day. That alien invasion movie? The first part where the aliens come and they look up between the buildings and the sky is gone and, like, all they see is metal? Just as far as you can see, that steel ship looming up there. I remember thinking, that's what the end of the world will look like. It won't be wars or a meteor. It'll be something we never could have thought of."
Awe choked off her voice. We all had entered the lobby and stopped in our tracks. The cavernous inner chamber of the Luxor was gold upon gold. Gold floors, gold walls, gold ceiling. The place was a temple, and there was no question who God was. The lobby was a pulsing crowd of people, and we were pushed ahead by the current. Everyone stared at us as they passed, eyes flicking from me to Jen to John's naked ass. I nervously adjusted the guitar strap around my neck. The shotgun was at my side, concealed under my coat. We probably drew the eyes of a dozen security guards working the floor. But at the sight of us, not a single one of them was thinking, gun. They were thinking, retards, sure, but not gun. John said, "Over there." He had found an entrance labeled Egyptian Ballroom, outside of which were two huge stand-up posters featuring a smiling 50-something man who must have been Dr. Marconi, since his name was boldly displayed under the picture. A lady sat at a table with a laptop PC and stacks of programs and brochures fanned out on a table. There were two guys in suits with thin cell phone headsets on, guarding the door. We strode toward them. My heart skipped a beat. This is as far as we had planned. As we neared, I glanced through the partially open door to see if anything was happening in there, such as Lucifer crashing up through the floor. He wasn't. What I could see was that the ballroom was huge, a floor like half a football field. In the center was an enormous ice sculpture that had to have been 15 feet high. It was an angel with its wings spread, hands upstretched to the ceiling. It must have had water pumping up through it, because a rain of liquid rolled off its crystalline wings like a waterfall, splashing into a pool at its feet. The crowd sat in rows of folding chairs around it. Every seat was taken. Each member of the audience had their eyes closed. The amplified voice of Dr. Marconi drifted into the lobby. "Okay, everyone, settle down. I know this is frightening for some of you, but what we're dealing with is real. Real is the person sitting next to you. But I need all of you, all of your concentration, all of that power, that openness of the mind for this to work. Now, we've just heard from Betty, who says her husband disappeared under mysterious circumstances last year. His name is Harold Alexander. Now, let's all concentrate on Harold Alexander. Now, clear your minds. Each of you picture in your head an apple." I had left the $6,000 from my envelope with a ponytailed roadie who gave us 15 minutes alone with a concert truck while he went off to smoke. The guitar slung over my back was made entirely of a crystal clear glass or polymer. I was wearing a white leather overcoat trimmed in long, luxuriant green fur and an enormous white sombrero edged in a pattern of fiber optic lights. Jennifer had donned a tailed white tuxedo ringmaster coat over her t-shirt and shorts, the coat long enough to leave only bare legs emerging from the hem. A black feather boa gave her an outfit that sort of looked intentional. Big Jim was wearing an incredibly tight roadie jumpsuit with a flashy Elton John logo on the back. He had a huge Casio keyboard under his arm and pulled a dolly behind him loaded down with two black boxes the size of footlockers. John wore a black jockstrap, a pair of white chaps, and a small purple Robin Hood cap that covered his groin. He was naked from the waist up, save for a tight leather vest and a bundle of gold chains. We all wore sunglasses. As we arrived at the table, Marconi's voice boomed. Now, everyone be calm. Who's next? Does anyone else have someone they'd like to contact?
The guards and check-in lady stared at us in confused amazement as we approached. The lady at the table, trying to suppress a smile, finally said,
"Oh, do you have tickets?"
"No. We're Elton John." "We're the band," I said, cutting him off quickly. "We're playing in there after the seance. Show us the back entrance and we'll..."
"Dave!" shouted John. "Look!"
It was Shitload. He was at the far end of the ballroom, shuffling between seats, moving toward the stage. He wore an ill-fitting suit jacket, jeans, and a cowboy hat that we knew covered a lumpy head wound.
"Yo, I got an old homie I'd like you to contact for me, fool," he said as he approached Marconi.
Dr. Marconi's smile faltered at the sight of Shitload, limping with joints bent at odd angles, his body puffy and stretched as if ready to burst. The jacket didn't completely conceal the gaping shotgun wound in his midsection. Shitload said, "His name is Korok, the slave master from the Eighth Plane, also known in some realms as Ba'ab, and in others as the Lord Xanthk, Al-Bazk, Shadil-Ul, Lut-Daz, Lizbzk, N'Knsnads." The guards and the door lady all turned their attention to him, not sure if this was part of the show, but sensing something was about to go way, way wrong. I stepped up to the door and ran my hand along my side, felt the long, rigid shotgun hidden behind my overcoat. I was about to tell door lady that we were in the midst of an emergency that only rock and roll could solve, and thus had to be let in at once.
"Gun!"
It was the guard to my left. I looked down, realized 6 inches of shotgun barrel was exposed where my coat had folded back. Quickly, I whipped it out and pointed it at his face, freezing him in mid-lunge. John said,
"It's not a gun. It's part of our act."
At the exact same moment, I said, "I'm a cop. I'm undercover." Then, over the loudspeaker,
"Ugh, my balls."
I spun and saw Dr. Marconi fall to the floor, grabbing his punched groin. Shitload loomed over him. Gasps rippled across the audience. I sprinted into the ballroom. Guards muscled past me, rushing the stage. Shitload punched the first guard in the groin so hard it flung his body back 5 feet. The other retreated. I raised the shotgun, leveling it at Shitload. "Freeze!" I shouted, for some reason. A lady screamed at the sight of the gun. Shitload turned his back to us and leaned forward. His pants split. A fleshy, puckering protrusion formed and pushed its way through the slit, looking like the end of a flesh trumpet.
Funt!
With a bassy thump and a smell like burnt sulfur, Shitload farted himself far into the air. The crowd went wild, chairs clanging down all around us. I tracked Shitload with the barrel of the shotgun as he climbed a hazy contrail of shimmery methane. He landed atop the giant ice angel. Shitload crouched on one wing, raised his arms in a touchdown motion, and said something at the top of his voice that was probably very profound and ominous, but was drowned out by the absolute bedlam in the crowd below. I fired. Shitload exploded.
"Hey, that was easy."
An eruption of blood and hamburger stained the wings of the angel red and pink. I felt a momentary euphoria of victory, ready to be carried off on shoulders. I should have known better. Out of Justin's guts poured not the white buzzing worms, but a shower of black specks that could have been coffee beans. They bounced and flecked off the wings of the angel and plinked into the water below. I edged up to the pool with the shotgun. Dark shapes started writhing and splashing below the surface. Oh, shit. A soft hand landed on my shoulder and I turned to see the sharp brown eyes of Albert Marconi.
"Son, I think we need to get the people out of here."
Big Jim was behind him, still toting the keyboard. Marconi said patiently,
"Don't you think? We haven't much time."
I turned, ran, fired the shotgun into the air and shouted, "Bomb! There's a bomb in the fountain. Everybody run for your lives. Please do not panic." The words were completely lost in the stampede caused by my shotgun blast. I bumped into John in the crowd.
"Where's the bomb?"
"There's no bomb. There's something in the... guys!"
It was Jen. She was yelling and pointing at the fountain. I turned just as one of the 7-legged wing monsters flung itself out of the pool in a spray of water. The beast landed on the carpet on its little baby-like hands, looked around, meowed, then disappeared. In a blink, it was clinging to the back of an elderly black woman, scorpion tail buried down into the base of her spine. Another of the little black beasts emerged. Another. Then 3 more. They crawled, leapt, clamped themselves onto victims. A fat guy went flailing past me with one of the things on his chest. A bearded man was trying to shake one off his leg. One of the wig monsters ran and jumped at Jim. He swatted it like a baseball with his Elton John keyboard, then bashed the heavy Casio in half over its prone body in a spray of white and black keys. Jen was on the other side of the fountain, kicking one of the beasts to death. I ran toward her, blew a wig monster in half, worked the pump, and realized I had no more shots. I flung the gun at another one of the monsters, missed, hit an elderly man in a wheelchair instead, toppling him over. I was kicking through the sea of blue chairs, closing on Jen. Two of the wig beasts were bearing down on me. No, three. One of them crouched and launched itself at me. Thunk. The beast was batted away by a folding chair, wielded by John. He screamed, "Yeah!" in a dead-on impersonation of pro wrestler Macho Man Randy Savage, grasping the folding chair by two legs. He swung again and flattened another one of the beasts, screaming, "Have a seat, bitch!" There were at least 100 of the wig monsters bouncing around the ballroom now. Victims littered the floor by the dozen. I flinched at the sound of a sharp gunshot, spun to see a middle-aged lady holding a little chrome pistol. She shot one of the things, killed it, took shots at another, missed. The beasts ganged up on her, three stinging her simultaneously. I heard someone shout, "Becky!" from behind me. A tall guy with a heavy brown beard pushed through the chairs. "Becky! Honey!" He punted two of the creatures off his wife with several furious kicks. Then John ran in and chaired the last one off, screaming, "You've been sentenced to get the chair, motherfucker!" The man helped his wife to her feet and said to me, "Those things, they're blocking the exits." I spun around, saw black clumps surrounding the doors we came in. "Shit!" The woman looked dazed. The man asked her if she was okay. She nodded, then calmly reached over with her left arm and tore the right arm out of its socket. It made a slimy sucking sound, like tearing the leg off a Thanksgiving turkey. There was no blood. The wound was instantly sealed by a thin, black layer of the soy sauce. She calmly walked back toward the fountain, casually carrying her arm like an umbrella. Her husband stood in dumbfounded silence. I heard John land two more blows with the chair. Another bite victim lay nearby, a young man writhing as if in a seizure. Eventually, his legs kicked themselves free from the rest of his body. The limbs thumped along the floor on their own, like two giant polyester snakes with chews for heads. Right behind them was a loose head stuck to a single arm, furiously biting and clawing the carpet. I felt like we might not be in control of this situation any longer. I heard a scream that I had come to recognize as Jennifer's. She was on her knees with Fred Switchblade, surrounded by five dead wig monsters all bearing ragged stab wounds. I sprinted that way. I heard a metallic thump from behind me and heard John yell, "You wants the committee, asshole, then you best meet with the chair." I pulled Jen to her feet. Around us, the disembodied human limbs were piling up, forming a circle around the fountain, fusing themselves to each other like Satan's Lego set. A wet, pink disembodied spine slithered past us like a snake. Dr. Marconi jogging toward us, shouting some instruction I couldn't hear in the pandemonium. All around us, the wig monsters were closing in, their dark shapes rolling in toward the fountain like oil down a drain. One of them jumped onto Jen's back. I flung myself at it, grabbed it in a bear hug and ripped it off her. One of its little fists came around and started punching me in the face. I carried it to the fountain, stepping over a squishy pile of body parts. I shoved the monster into the water, held it under, screamed, "Die," or something to that effect. After a few seconds, it stopped moving, and black sauce oozed out of it like an oil slick. Dr. Marconi got close enough so I could finally hear him. He said, "They're trying to get into the water. Don't let them." I looked back down at the spreading black pool, heard a splash as another of the beasts jumped in, followed by another, the creatures returning to the pool from which they had sprung. Nothing good could come from that. Marconi said, "Follow me." We sprinted toward a set of doors behind the stage, John smacking creatures with chairs as we went. Marconi unlocked the doors and we filed in. John stopped and spun in front of the open doorway. He faced at least a half a dozen of the wig monsters circling in on him. He whipped the chair around and actually split one of the things in half with the impact, spilling a spray of blood that was reflective, like mercury. John bellowed, "Anyone else want to donate blood to charity?" He ducked into the door, stopped, thought for a moment, then flung the door open again. He swung the chair and bashed one monster right in the wig, screaming, "There's some dessert! With a cherry on top!" He came back in again, breathing heavily, slamming the door just as something thumped against it. I said, "How about we just stay in here until they all leave?" Dr. Marconi took off his glasses and cleaned them with a handkerchief. John said, "What's happening to them out there? The bite victims?" He looked at Marconi. "We've got friends who took the soy sauce, the venom those things out there spit out. Almost all of them died, but not like..."
"Out there, you have a room full of true believers," Marconi said sadly. "There's a shift that goes on, you see, physically and mentally and spiritually. They were ripe for this."
Something hammered against the door, and one hinge popped out in a burst of plaster dust. Big Jim and John leaned against the door to brace it. I said, "Wait, you know what's going on here?" He gave me a dismissive look.
"I'll send you home with a copy of my book."
Big Jim said, "He's trying to break through, isn't he?" Marconi nodded.
"He, or his lackeys, yes."
"God damn it," I screamed. "Did everybody else know this was going to happen but me?"
"I most certainly did not know this was going to happen," Marconi said, "or I would have canceled and issued full refunds. But when I became aware of the source, as you call it, I knew that it only had one purpose."
There was a scratching from beyond the opposite side of the door that I suspected was the sound of the beasts trying to bite through it.
"And that purpose is?"
"I offer people a window into the spiritual. Someone wishes to turn it into a door."
A blue eye in the darkness. Jim whispered,
"The devil."
Marconi said,
"Son, the greatest trick the devil ever pulled was convincing the world there was only one of him."
I held up a hand in a halt motion and said, "How do we get out of this?" Marconi placed his glasses back on his nose and said,
"We're like one German soldier, alone, on the beaches of Normandy on D-Day, holding a sharp stick. I assure you, son, if any of us were capable of destroying such evil, the world would have killed us long before now. The world turns, son, and now it turns into the darkness."
I said, "So what do you suggest?"
"I am a retired priest. Did you know that?"
John asked,
"Are you one of those priests who can shoot lasers out of their eyes? Because that would be really helpful right now."
"No," he said, "but I can bless water to make it holy. The ice statue, I mean."
John's face brightened and he said,
"That's perfect."
He thrust his index finger into the air.
"We bless the ice, then we just have to somehow get all 100 or so of those monsters to go lick the statue."
I stared hard into the face of the older man, said, "Okay, there is no possible combination of English words that would form a dumber plan than that."
"We need to buy time, of course," he said undeterred, "but if I'm right, if they're doing what I think they're doing, it's most likely the only hope we've got. The travelers out there, the beasts, I mean, they do have a weakness."
John said,
"We know. Chairs."
Not exactly. They're natural discordians. It's a product of where they're from, you see. When you live in a world of black noise, melody is like a blade to the ears, angels and their harps and all that."
I asked, "What does that have to do with—" A hole exploded from the center of the door. A little pink fist and a segmented leg curled through, reaching around between John and Big Jim. John grabbed it by the wrist and Jennifer severed the arm with the switchblade. There was a feline shriek from the other side. John held the detached arm in his hand for a moment, then shoved it back through the ragged hole. Marconi said,
"I see you have instruments. Can any of you sing? The old spirituals work best."
John said,
"I can sing."
I said, "No, you can't, John."
"Well, I play the guitar."
"So can I," said Big Jim. "We have two guitars." I said,
"This could not be any stupider."
John said,
"Dave, you remember the words to Camel Holocaust?"
"Ah, once again, you prove me wrong, John." Marconi looked down at the two carts stacked with amps and cables and said, "How long is it?"
"I'll need several minutes."
John stepped around and lifted the guitar off my back, said,
"Camel Holocaust is as long as you want it to be, my friend. I'm lead, Jim is rhythm, Jen sings backup. Jen,
Just repeat everything Dave sings, only like 1 second behind. The sound system will be on the stage. We duck out there and plug in and wail, okay? Guys, this is just retarded enough to work.
We set up, then faced the banging door. John said,